Yeah. First of all, thanks for having us. It's really nice to be here. And today I wanted to tell you a bit about a couple of new things. And while preparing this talk, I realized I need to tell you about like a lot of the stuff that we did in the last 5 years or so. So there's going to be a long sort of introductory story to this. But in the end, we will get to pairing and we'll get to frustration, I hope. Okay. So first of all, is there actually any way to have like a clicker here? Because it's blocking the USB.
Yes, I'll be there.
Yeah, that doesn't matter. Okay. So anyway, so what people in condensed matter typically do is they start from some cool effect that they actually see in some real material, and then we try to understand it. And I don't touch any real material, so I have nothing to do with that. But what people like I really try to do is to find a microscopic model that basically is as easy as it gets, but also captures all of the interesting stuff that we are trying to describe here. And then once you came up with some model, you can, like either do analytics or numerics or maybe the newest thing, some quantum simulation. And the kind of motivation for what I'm looking at, so the Fermi-Hubbard model, is based on superconductivity. And superconductivity is something that has a story that goes longer back. So originally, superconductivity was discovered in 1911, and then it basically took something like 46 years for theorists to find, really to understand what's going on in conventional superconductivity. And since it took so long, people basically started calling superconductivity the shame and despair of theoretical physics. And now, in 1986, high-temperature superconductivity was discovered, and it became clear pretty soon that this theory of conventional superconductivity is not enough to describe what's going on in these materials. Okay, now we are like in 2022, and it's not the shame and despair of theoretical physics, but it's definitely a problem worthwhile to look into. Okay, but of course, a couple of things are known, and I would say the simplest model that people believe captures some or most of the physics of these materials is the Fermi-Hubbard model. Of course, there's a lot of other ingredients that you can throw into it, but I think most people would agree that the Fermi-Hubbard model itself already describes a lot of interesting physics on its own. So the Fermi-Hubbard model is really comparably simple. You have fermions with spin up and spin down. They're here like these blue and red balls, and they hop. In our case, we're looking at a square lattice, so they hop on the square lattice with an hopping amplitude t, and when they end up on the same side, they pay an interaction energy u. The problem with this is now that the Hilbert space dimension, of course, grows very rapidly. And it turns out that this is something that's pretty challenging for most numerical methods at hand. And one way out of this is now, as I already mentioned before, quantum simulation. And now there is a lot of different platforms for quantum simulation. So here there's just some examples like trapped ions, superconducting qubits, so like Rydberg atoms and optical tweezers, and cold atoms and optical lattices. And for now, I think, as we are speaking, cold atoms and optical lattices are probably the best candidate simply because you can directly take fermions and put them in your optical lattice, which with the other platforms is kind of difficult. So you have to somehow map from bosons to fermions. Okay, so what I'm mostly going to talk about is, in terms of quantum simulation, is cold atoms in optical lattices. So these experiments look horribly complicated, and it's quite impressive, but what they really end up doing in the end is taking images like this. So this is from Markus Greiner's group, an image. And what you really see here is what these fermionic atoms are doing when you put them in an optical lattice. And basically, you see here all these different lattice sites, and you see the fluorescent light from those atoms. And what you really find here is that you get some sort of antiferromagnetic order already in the system. So, I mean, I'm a theorist, so I don't need to be that much concerned with this setup, but the outcome of this are these projective measurements of your quantum system. So you realize the quantum state of interest, you take projective measurements of that state, you get snapshots like this, and then you can look at them and basically evaluate whatever you want from them. So, and that's kind of one of the main questions. What should you be looking for in this particular snapshot, right? So you get snapshots, maybe a couple of hundred or thousand of them, which look something like this, which basically, in a way, contain a lot of information about the state. But also, as a theorist, the question is really what should you be looking for in those snapshots? Okay, so going back to answer the question to the Fermi-Hubbard model. So basically, we're typically interested in the limit of large U, so very large interaction strength. And that means it's typically fair to map it onto the TJ model, which at least I think is conceptually a bit easier, because you project out double occupancies. And we still keep this hopping term here, but we don't have any double occupancies anymore. And for that, we get a spin exchange term. So this is an S.S term with like this super exchange J in front of it. So what this term really wants is anti-fermionic ordering. So if we look at half filling when we have exactly one fermion per lattice side, the system is, I would say, fairly well understood. So you start at high temperature with a metal, and then as you go to temperatures below your interaction strength U, you get charge order, which means that actually you do have one atom or like one fermion sitting on each lattice side. And as you lower the temperatures even further, you do get spin order. And that's because you basically, if you're at half filling, you mainly care about this term here, so you try to minimize your super exchange energy here. So in like a pictorial picture, what you want is spin up next to spin down and so on. Okay, so this is kind of evaluated from the pictures that I showed you before. So this is now a spin correlation map. So the question that they asked here is, given this spin in the center is say up, what's the probability of finding any of these other spins being up or down, right? And so what you see here is this nice checkerboard pattern that comes out. So basically, the point of this is, if you look at a two-point correlation function given a certain spin pointing up, what's the probability of finding another spin being up or down at a given distance? What you find is that you will get this kind of checkerboard pattern here. So that's kind of what you would expect at half filling, right? That you get this nice anti-ferromagnetic ordering out of the system. Okay, that's basically what I told you before. And now, if you look at the phase diagram, so far I was really only talking about really this axis here. So we're exactly at half filling. And a lot of the interesting stuff that's happening is at finite doping. So finite doping means basically you punch holes into your antiferromagnet. And so this thing here is something. Right. So what we really want to know or better understand is what happens or what should we be looking for as we punch holes into our antiferromagnet. This is kind of a sketch of a phase diagram. I drew this in Keynote, so like, I mean, don't take any of this at face value, but this is the kind of phases that people in general expect to happen here. So maybe there is superconductivity, maybe there isn't. The pseudogap phase, strange metal, and so all of this interesting stuff happens as you go away from this kind of understood axis of your antiferromagnet and put holes into your system. So something that I spent basically my whole PhD on is asking this question, what happens if you put a single hole into the system? And for that, together with Fabian and Eugene, you basically developed this geometric string theory. And the idea is now, so you again have this TJ Hamiltonian here. So the two things that you have is this spin exchange energy and the hole hopping T. And now as you put a hole into this cartoon antiferromagnet and it hops through the system, you basically get this string, that's why it's called geometric string theory, of displaced spins along this trace. So here you can see now these spins are now aligned instead of anti-aligned. And what this means is basically for each segment of the string, you have to pay a string tension energy. And this string tension energy is basically given by the difference in correlation functions. So this correlator here used to be this nearest neighbor correlation function, but it's replaced by this next nearest neighbor correlation function. And those are typically ferromagnetic, these are anti-ferromagnetic, just because you have this background AFM pattern. And that means basically that you get a string tension which scales with something like J. So what happens is that the holes, or like scales to single hole, wants to delocalize with the hole hopping T. And it fights against this linear potential because the more it hops, the more of this string tension it has to pay. And the nice thing now is that this is more or less a single particle description because this is more or less a linear potential. We get rid of the whole spin background and we just say, okay, what happens if this hole, this particle, hops with hopping amplitude T in a potential that's given by this term here. So the main idea to make this work is that you make a kind of Born-Oppenheimer approximation because when I'm saying this, what I'm really describing is this string part of the wave function. So I say I can describe my TJ model with a single hole as this product ansatz of the spinon background and the string. So basically, as I create a hole, I create the spin excitation, the spinon, and the charge excitation. And what I'm saying is that the spin excitation, the spin background, is much slower than the charge excitation. It's kind of this one-upon approximation. So what I'm saying is the spin background doesn't have the chance to react to anything that this chargeon is doing here. And therefore, I can basically describe this motion of the chargeon with this whole string theory ansatz, with the single particle ansatz, and kind of separate what the two of them are doing. And that's kind of better to treat, to describe any properties of this. Okay, so far so good.
Okay. So what's the energy scale determines the motion of the chargeon?
Yeah, so the motion of the chargeon, right, is determined by the hole hopping T in general. And that's kind of why we can make this ansatz, right? Because the motion of this thing is determined by T, and T is typically much larger than the spin exchange energy J. And so what we typically look at is T over J.
The Hubbard U doesn't enter the game.
I mean, the Hubbard U enters in J, right? So J is 4T squared over U. Okay. And therefore, if you look at something like...
But the charge only depends on T. Has nothing to do with U.
Yeah. So we typically look at T over J 2 to 3, so U over T, like A to 14 or something like that.
Can you go back one slide, please? So in this expression that you had, this one now, this one. So on the left-hand side, you have a derivative over space. So that's the growth of the change.
Yes, so that's basically the energy for each like line segment of this string is given by this. So as I make, basically, I mean, as I make this longer and longer, if you integrate over this, you just get like a factor of L, basically, right?
And the 2 is because you have?
The 2 is because you go up and down.
And that's the equation to consider. So there are no, this is going to go.
That's a good question. Since I wanted to not go into too much detail, I just kept it as what we call kind of the linear string approximation. Of course, in principle, you can like go around corners, and then two things can happen. Like one of them is that this relationship is not exact anymore, right? Because basically here, like this equation only comes out because these correlations behave in the way if I now go up and so on, I exchange different correlations. And so this is something that you can directly treat, because what I typically do is when I do a calculation for this, I just, you know, like calculate which correlations I end up with as nearest neighbors. So it's just a question of bookkeeping to figure out, once you put a string through, which sites are now nearest neighbors, which relationship they had before, and then plug in the correct correlator here. So that's a problem that you can solve. The other thing is that you will get self-interactions of the string, and that's a bit more tricky, right? Because if the string goes like this, then you might have like interactions within the string.
I'm okay if this just represents quantitatively. Or
yes. Yeah.
Right, because it shouldn't be a DEDL, right? This is a discrete change in position. Can you repeat then what you said about charge and spin going at different speeds? So this excitation is excitation for what?
All right. So what I did here is I created a hole into the system. And when I do that, I basically create both, right? A spin 1/2 excitation and a charge 1 excitation. And now what I'm saying is when you basically, what this describes is only the motion of the charge excitation. So this whole geometric string theory only gives you a prescription of what the kind of charge-on part of excitation does. But you basically, I mean, this is a kind of cartoon picture of your antiferromagnet, but you also create this spin excitation here. And in principle, like if you have, you know, like S dot S terms, the spin excitation can also move through the system. But that's something that happens on different timescales. And so we kind of separate these two motions from each. So we basically say, we first, like, there is this heavy part, which is the spin-on. And then there is this like fast charge-on part going around it.
I see how the lack of an electron there, that's the fact, the charge that is moving fast. But why is, so I can see also a lot of, you know, three spin-ups or down in the same column. That looks like spin excitation as well, or should I not think about that?
Right, but I mean, this is kind of the, yes, so there is kind of two separate things, right? The first one is the spin 1/2 excitation that you, like, I think it's a bit easier to see in 1D, right? If you draw like a 1D chain, and then you basically kill this guy here, right? Then, so here you have a hole now. Then what you created is a single spin 1/2 excitation. And now, like basically, okay, the hole can hop through a system, right? Then you end up with this. And then you have a single domain wall, right? But if you do something, for example, if you started here, and instead of killing this guy, you exchange those two spins, what you end up with is two of these domain walls, right? So this is kind of like a bit of a different, like, of course, now you can say these two can also like propagate like separately through the system. But this is kind of the single, this is what we would call a spinon, because it's like a single spin 1/2 excitation that we put into the system. And in our 2D picture, everything that happens through the motion of the hole, just displacing, is part of the string, and we just describe it as the string object itself. And like this spin 1/2 excitation that we create in the beginning is kind of a bit separate from that. Maybe.
So the logic is just very clear for reviewing it, but in two dimensions, precisely, you know, that picture doesn't hold anymore, and you have these columns of three spin up or three spin down. So we just don't think about, you said this is part of the string, and we don't think of this as a spin excitation.
I mean, it's like, I mean, that's why you pay this string tangent energy, right? Because you have an exciting like excitation in your spin sector. That's precisely why you get the string tangent.
But you said the spinon is stuck at the beginning of.
I mean, okay. So what can happen now, of course, is that you have dynamics within the spin sector too, right? So like, what can happen, for example, is if you go and have like an exchange process here, then you would say, okay, now you got rid of part of your string, right? And the idea is because the J is much smaller than the T, you kind of, on average, can still treat the whole string as an object which has this string tension, and you don't care so much about like single like spin exchange process which happen along the string. I don't know if that clarifies.
Okay, thank
you. So Saito and Fisher, they had a model going back to spin charge separation and the keep rates. How does this differ from that Z2 Saito Fisher model?
I'm not exactly sure which model you. So I mean, there is basically earlier work where they, I mean, this is kind of the work from like Boyevsky, for example, where they had very similar theories already for this kind of thing, right? Where you basically, I mean, the one approximation that you really make is that you can treat the string as an object which will be there more or less, which will not completely decay. And then you basically separate your spin and charge dynamics from each other. So this is like the basic idea has been kind of around.
Just want to make sure you are not claiming you have spin charge separation.
No. That's actually a good point. So I mean, this is kind of the opposite of spin charge separation, right? Because you have very strong correlations between spin and charge, and you need to take them into account. Yes, exactly. They are confined to each other. Okay. So there is a lot of things that you can check for now. I don't want to go into any details of them, but so maybe I find maybe the most intuitive is this one here. So what you're looking at is a numerical simulation of the TJ model, where we start without a hole, and then at time zero we create a hole. So this is as a function of time, the distance that this hole has traveled. And what you see here now, so the dark red one is a time-dependent MPS calculation, and you see that it first spreads out quickly. And that's when the string object forms. So this is basically the hole kind of exploring this linear potential that I was talking about. And then at some point, the string tangent kicks in, and it cannot go any further because it has basically reached the limit of where it can go within this linear potential. But now you have this bound object of the spin excitation and the charge excitation. So you have this whole string object. And now the string object can only move as fast as the spin excitation can move through the system. So what you will get at longer times is basically the hole. So I mean, the hole is just easy to look for, right? Because you just calculate the expectation value of the hole density. And the hole travels at a speed which is determined by the super exchange J now. So we have like first and fast spreading out with T, and then at long times it just spreads out with J. And this like this shaded line here is basically this geometric string theory prediction, which matches pretty nicely with the actual simulation of the TJ model. And there is a couple of other things that you can look for. For example, if you have like a particle in a linear potential, what you should get is vibrational excitations of this thing. And that's what we see here, like these red dots is basically, so there is a certain scaling which is predicted for that. And these red dots basically show that you do find in the spectral function these vibrational excitations. So basically, the point of this slide is mainly to establish that for a single hole, the picture seems to describe a lot of the properties that we see in numerics. Okay, so the question is then what happens with many holes, right? Oh, sorry, yeah, one slide in between. So one thing that you can do, and so for example, when I just look at where the hole travels as a function of time and so on, I just take the average, I just take the expectation value of the hole density. But if you now have something like a quantum gauss microscope, what you can actually do is quantum predictive measurements, which means that if your state is some superposition, for example, like for the case of what we're looking at now, some different configurations of your string. Now, one thing that you can do is just average over your quantity. And what will just give you is like this kind of dressing cloud here. So we'll just get this quasi dressing cloud, right? And this is kind of like a picture that a lot of people also work with, and it also describes a lot of properties, of course. If you just look at a magnetic polaron as kind of this hole which is dressed by this excitations of your spin background. So that's definitely not wrong, but I think it misses a lot of the details of this microscopic configuration here. And if you now take your quantum gauss microscope, what you can do is you take those projective measurements and, you know, in one measurement you might measure this configuration, in another measurement you might measure this configuration, and so on. So you have a lot of more information, and basically you should be looking for that information, right? Okay, so what we can do now with this geometric string theory prediction, it doesn't tell us anything about the background at half-filling, but it basically tells us how we get from half-filling to finite doping. And here, we make another approximation, which is that we don't assume that the holes talk to each other. So if you put in n holes, we put in n times one hole. So what we basically do is we have this geometric string theory. It basically tells us, okay, you should have this distribution of string lengths. So we take these snapshots at half-filling, and put in holes and then move them through the system with a string length, which we basically sample from this simple single particle theory. And with that, we basically get a new deck of snapshots at a given doping value that we care about, which is what this geometric string theory describes. So of course, this is now one theory for the doped Fermi-Hubbard model. So could be right, could be wrong, right? There is, of course, a lot of other theories around, and one of them is from Anderson, this REB state. And the idea here is basically that you have this covering of your lattice. So here I only drew nearest neighbor singlets. You could also do like other distances. So you get this covering of singlets of your lattice, and the holes kind of move more or less freely through the soup of singlet coverings of your system. And now what you can, so it's basically, it gives you a sort of trial wave function. If you start from a Fermi C here, you do a good sort of projection, you end up with your RVB state. What we want to do is to do this at finite temperature, right? Because like this is kind of where the experiments we're interested in work at. So we're not in the ground state. We're like kind of fairly high up here. So we want to look at a finite temperature state. But actually, that's not so much harder, because basically we can also start from a mean field Hamiltonian, right? And do a Goodswiller projection. And we want snapshots because we want to compare to actual experimental data. But that's also kind of something that comes naturally out of it, because we can just do Metropolis Monte Carlo sampling according to this. And basically in this sampling, we can automatically do this Goodswiller projection. So that's also nice for us. So this is a way to get snapshots both for the geometric string theory as described earlier, and also for a specific kind of this RVB state that Anderson proposed. And so honestly, actually why we started looking at this was that we had this geometric string theory and we compared it to experimental data and it looked really good. So we were like, okay, that's cool. But then people were like, yeah, but have you compared to other theories? So we wanted kind of like a theory that we can use as a punching bag. So we wanted a theory that's kind of like somewhat respectable, but also we were sure should be worse, right? Because it's kind of, I mean, it's like a mean field Hamiltonian, right? So we were like, this must be worse.
So what do you consider pi plus theory here?
Yes, yeah, that's a good question. So in principle, you could do any other flux. You could also do a staggered field. I think the motivation for pi flux was that, like, people I think, showed it in the ground state in the like limit of large n, this gives you the exact solution. And then other people showed that at finite temperature, this gives you, compared to other of these trial states, gives you a good estimate, like a good free energy. But it's somewhat arbitrary, really, which REB state you specifically use. So it's definitely, it's actually something, yeah, that we got more curious about also, whether some different answers would be better or worse, or like whether this is like specifically good answers.
So what's a electron? So you consider finite doping of it?
Yes, yeah. So, I mean, basically what we are looking at is for each doping, we can generate snapshots right from this geometric string theory by just putting more or less strings into the system. And from this theory, basically, I mean, you just fill up your Fermi C in a way, right? So yeah, so we basically consider dopings between 0 and 30%.
Okay.
But this prescription is
pretty. The high class theory is special because it's only special at half phi.
You mean because it's like equivalent to the D wave?
If you have pipe flux at half filling, then get dual cones. That's the original motivation to study something. I think we're pretty sure now that state is not spin liquid. Pipe flux theory is not spin liquid in the
end. At finite doping or at
half filling.
At half filling, yes. Yes, I mean, so one motivation for us is definitely that we. Kind of given the prescription of the geometric string theory, we know that we start from something that's very good at half filling because we basically base it on half filling, right? And so we wanted to use something where we think that it's a good approximation at half filling too, and then see how we get away from that. Yes, but I fully agree that you could and should look at other of these states.
Yeah, indeed, for that purpose, it's actually close to that.
Yeah.
Because the Pi-Far theory, in the end, it's actually just Heisenberg antifeld magnets. It's not spin liquid.
Yeah. I mean, it's a pretty good description of half filling. Yes. It's a pretty good description of half filling, and that's kind of what we aim for. To, I don't know, in a trying to put less bias into it, to have something where what should be a good description of half filling, Okay, so we did that, and then what should you be looking for, right? And so this is kind of the snapshots that you get out. So this is snapshots from I think 9% doping, from the geometric string theory, from this pi flux state, and from the actual experiment. And you see it's kind of like they look all the same, right? Like if you stare at them, they look all pretty much the same. So the question really is, if you have now a lot of these snapshots, like thousands of them, what should you be looking for? Like you, and the point really of these snapshots is that in principle you can go now and evaluate all types of higher order correlation functions, right? Okay, but like the natural thing is to start with two-point correlation functions, and like specifically two-point spin correlation functions, because we know that at half filling you should get this anti-ferromagnetic ordering, which means we kind of know what the like spin background should look like at half filling. So it's natural to ask, as we tune the doping here, how do those spin correlations evolve through the system? And now what you're looking at is, so the symbols is always experimental data, and the curves are different theories. So in this case, the green curve is this geometric string theory, and the dashed curve is this pi flux theory. And you see that they are both like pretty good descriptions. So actually surprisingly good descriptions, right? Because you go with, in both cases, actually, you go with something where you are like, okay, this should be good at half filling, and then you go to something like 20 or 30% doping, and it's still a pretty good description of what's happening. In this case here, I would, in my completely biased view, say that the string theory is maybe a better description because it captures the sign change here, but I mean, the pi flux theory is also doing pretty well here. And then in this case, like here is for some reason no x-axis, but the doping range goes from 0 to 80% even. And again, the symbols is experimental data, and there is like different correlation functions you can look at. There is like a lot going on in these plots, but what you see, and here we actually also looking at the uniform REB state, but what you see is really that like all the theories kind of make very similar predictions, and they are kind of like, at least up to some intermediate doping, they pretty well actually describe what's going on experimentally. So if you ask the question, which of these theories now describes the experiment better, it's very hard to make a call based on something like this. And of course, now if you look at those snapshots, you can go and evaluate whatever correlation function you want. But the question really is, what correlation function should you be looking for? Because, I mean, the spin correlation functions are somewhat physically motivated from what we understand at half-filling. But as you go to finite doping, it becomes trickier to see which correlation functions you should be looking at. Okay, so what we did then was to train a neural network to distinguish the two theories and basically learn this to a certain degree, not as good as we had hoped, because the two theories are pretty similar. But for a given doping value, the network would get a snapshot and then put on it either the label geometric string theory or PyFlux theory. And once the training was finished, we then like fixed the network parameters and put in experimental data. And now the network, of course, didn't have a label experimental data, but only had a label for each of the two theories. So it had to assign to each experimental snapshot that we like put in, it had to assign the label of either theory. So the question is basically, as we do this, how many experimental snapshots get the label geometric string theory and how many get the label PyFlux theory? And this is what came out. So basically, as a function of doping, but it's somewhat redundant because the data here is like these, of course, have to sum up to one. But what you see is the fraction of experimental snapshots that get detected as either of the two theories. And what you find is the difference is not huge, but it looks like this geometric string theory is a somewhat better description up to something like 15% or so doping. So this is nice because it took into account the whole information in the snapshot, right? There was everything that we could like use, all these higher order correlations that are in there were used, and we get kind of an answer that between those two theories, the geometric string theory seems to be the better one. I was happy, but I always got the question, okay, but what is the network looking for? So I was happy for a year, but then I realized, okay, we need to figure out what the network is actually looking for. And for that, we basically developed a new network architecture. And the idea here is that it's very physics motivated. So before we also used a convolutional neural network. So this means that you start with an input image and then you convolve it with some filter, and the weights within this filter are learned. And this part we still do, but instead of having like a standard nonlinear activation function, we now do an expansion in orders of the correlators. So basically what you see here is a correlator map, and this correlation map can be any arbitrary higher order correlator. And this is like a first order correlator or like a local observer, like just like a spin expectation value basically. But you then can go to higher and higher orders up to whatever order you want to go to. And the network basically learns which higher order correlation function is the most important in making the classification task at hand. So you ask the question, in our case, we ask the question, distinguish these two theories. And what the network would tell us is not only like, you know, like distinguishing those two theories, but it would tell us which exact higher order correlation function is the most important in making this classification task. Yes.
So in a previous slide, you showed the comparison between different RVB theories and the geometric string theory. But it seemed that the uniform RVB was better than all of the others. So yeah, in that right-hand side plot, isn't the green line following experimental data?
Yes, yeah. So chronologically, this was the last of these things that we did. So yes, I agree that like if you look at this data only, then the green line is definitely somewhat better than the others. But then again, if you like, this is only looking at 2-point correlation functions. If you also look at some higher order spin charge correlation functions, each of these theories has their own failures. Yeah. Yes, but I agree. So that's what I also meant earlier. So basically in this, we have to go through all of this again. But in this, basically what we should also be looking at is other like RVB answers. Okay, so what we found here then when we did this is that actually a fourth order correlator is the most relevant one. So basically this was now at 6% doping, just to pick one doping. And if you want to distinguish between geometric string theory and this PyFlux theory, then you don't need to even start looking at 2 or 3rd order point correlation functions, but 4th order correlation functions are the most relevant. And for a snapshot to get classified as geometric string theory, these are kind of the correlators that the network is looking for. And if we go back to the sketch that I drew of the geometric string theory, it's kind of makes a lot of sense, right? Because, for example, if you look at this, what you get is really a hole where you have this kind of aligned spins next to it. And this is kind of the same all over the place here. And the other thing is, of course, this is the part of the string itself, right? And these are exactly the patterns that you would expect if you come from this geometric string theory picture. So it's neat because we understand on a physical level why this should be geometric string theory. And this is something that you can actually go and look for. And what I'm not showing here is the correlators that indicate the pi flux state, mainly because I have no idea what's going on there. So it's basically like it's not as easy understandable as these images are for geometric string theory, and kind of makes sense because if you just have these super singlets and you take projective images, it makes sense that you don't get anything super understandable out of that. Okay, but these correlations we can actually also go and look for experimentally, and it's so here we're looking at basically the correlations relative to a given hole, and what we find is that these spin correlations, I don't want to go into too much details, but they are red here, which means they are positive. And then as we cross something like 18 to 20% doping, they actually change sign. And this is, of course, also where in this earlier plot here, and also like within this phase diagram to some extent, we saw that things got messier and like it wasn't as clear anymore that the geometric string theory would be the better description. Okay, so far so good. This is like the half hour backstory. So what we had learned at this point, basically after my PhD, was that the geometric string theory is a good description. But then the natural question was, so far, we basically always looked at single holes. And we basically, even if we went to finite doping, what we did was to treat like a finite amount of holes, we would treat each hole separately and never look at the interaction between the holes. So a very, very natural question, if you also like look at the Fermi-Hubbard model and you might or might not think that there is superconductivity in there, is to ask whether these charges can also form pairs of charge carriers. So what about pairing? And then we realized that actually, if you go to a slightly modified model, so you don't look at the plain vanilla Fermi-Hubbard or TJ model anymore, then you actually do get very strong pairing based on this string theory answers. And the other thing that we realized is, okay, this RVB state does not capture these higher order spin charge correlations correctly. But one question that you can ask is, what is actually going on in the spin background? Okay, so these are the kind of two new and exciting things that I want to talk about. Okay, and for that, we go to the mixed dimensional systems. And so this looks maybe more complicated than it is. But the main idea of the mixed dimensional systems is that you have spin exchange couplings in both directions. So you see here this J parallel along this direction, and you see the J perp along this direction. But the T is now only in this case, in 1D. So basically, I mean, I'm drawing a ladder here, but in principle, the spin exchange couplings go in 2D. So that's a two-dimensional spin system. But the whole motion is only in 1D anymore. That's why it's mixed dimension, because the charge motion is 1D, and the spin is seeing a 2D system. And now for a ladder, this is kind of very special, because in a ladder, what you get is, if you are at half filling now, you will get something like this, where you have strong singlets along the rungs. And now you can do, of course, the same thing for a bilayer system. That's a bit harder to draw on a slide. But again, if you have like your J perp as the strongest energy and you have no holes in your system, what you will get is basically singlets along the rungs of your bilayer system. And the question now, of course, my standard question is, what happens if you put a hole into the system? And the nice thing about this whole like bilayer and like mixed dimensional ladder, whatever story is, that this is something that's not crazy because you can do it in cold atom experiments. And these are like all examples where people actually did this. So for example, I mean, here they did like several ladders next to each other. Here they have like bilayer systems, and you see they have this whole thing where they like then separate them from each other to take images separately of the upper and the lower bilayer. Here in Martin Suhrlein's group, they also have these like bilayer systems. And here they even looked at the correlation function. So they basically ask, if I tune the coupling between my two layers, what do the correlation functions look like? So I think here we only care about the red lines. So this is basically the spin correlations between, within the layer, which go down as you enhance the coupling between the two layers. And then The other thing, the interlayer correlations, so the correlations between the two layers go up. So this basically just tells you if you're at half filling and you increase, so half filling, you don't even need to do mixed dimensional, half filling and you increase the coupling between your two layers, then you basically get stronger spin correlations between your two layers. That makes, of course, a lot of sense, like intuitively. Okay, and so now, if you put a hole into the system, you basically, and you have the hole just move in 1D. This is kind of the perfect model system for this whole geometric string theory story. Because what happens is that the hole moves, and it tilts those singlets. And that means for each hop that it makes, it basically breaks up one of those singlets that you had before, in the sense that you pay this energy cost on this rung of your ladder or rung of your bilayer 2D system. And now within this geometric string theory picture, if you ask whether you get pairing, what you need to ask really is it cheaper to have two spin-on-charge-on strings or to have a single charge-on-charge-on string? The idea is, of course, if you have a charge-on-charge-on string, then the charges basically share one string, and therefore they don't need to mess up the spin background as much as two separate strings would maybe do. And it turns out if you do geometric string theory calculation, it predicts that you do get very large binding energies. So basically, what it tells you is that you get binding energies which scale with something like t to the 1/3. So this t is really the hole hopping in the 1D direction or in the layer direction in case of bilayers. And this so this is super nice, right? Because it means as you make the holes more mobile, your binding energy also gets larger. And what you're looking at here now is the binding energy as a function of this t parallel here. So this t parallel over j perp to the 1/3. So this is the scaling that this string theory predicts. And the string theory prediction is basically this dark green line. And of course, like you don't have to believe the string theory calculation, because for a ladder system, you can just do DMRG and calculate the binding energy of the model. And these are these green symbols. And you see that they actually agree pretty nicely. So basically, you get binding energies, which are positive. So you get strong pairing in the whole parameter regime that we are considering. And these binding energies are on the order of J perp. And that's, of course, great, because J perp is a very large energy scale. So J perp, or like the spin exchange coupling J, for example, also in cold atom experiments, is something that they can reach right now. So this means that we have this mechanism where you can get pairing in a model which is like microscopically purely repulsive, right? I mean, this is based kind of on a Fermi-Hubbard model, where you basically just inhibit the tunneling between the legs or between the two layers. And it tells you that you get pretty strong binding energies for this model. The other thing that we can look at is whether, again, as I told you before, these like predictions are true. So this is like a spectral function. And I mentioned this briefly before, but if you put particle into a linear potential, you should see vibrational excitations. And that's exactly what you see here. So the color map is basically a matrix product state calculation. And these like dashed lines that you see here is what the parton model predicts. And you see that they agree extremely nicely. So what this tells you is that the geometric string theory is really a very good model for these mixed dimensional bilayer or ladder systems, which like not only predict the energies, but also kind of the excited states of your model pretty well here. And so this is for a single hole. And what you see for a single hole is, again, this is the spectral function. So what you're looking at here is the dispersion. And you see that a single hole doesn't move that much. So this dispersion is pretty flat. The reason being that this is, again, attached to the spin excitation. The spin excitation is kind of slow. Now, if you put two holes together and look at the spectral function of two holes, again, you get these nice vibrational lines here. So again, this is pretty neat because this kind of geometric string theory works very well. But the other thing that you get is that these two holes actually move through the system pretty quick, like fast, because this dispersion is really on the scale of t. So that means that you really get strong pairing. So you get like large binding energies. And the pairs that you get also are mobile, so they can actually move through your system. And kind of the third nice feature is that you can also realize it experimentally. So this is done mainly by Sarah and a group of Immanuel Bloch. And they did it for a ladder, but in principle, they could also do it for a bilayer system. I think it's just more work, but it's not something that's like any real technical problem. And the way they do it is to basically have an offset between the two legs of the ladder. That means that basically the tunneling is off resonant, but you still keep your super exchange intact. It just gets like a slightly different form heap. With that, they can realize these mixed dimensional ladders. And what we're comparing, like what we're looking at here now, is the G2 function between two legs of this ladder now. The blue points is the mixed dimensional system, and the brown dots is like the standard Fermi-Hubbard ladder. And what you see is that in the mixed dimensional case, two holes really tend to sit very closely together. So you basically, so this is the distance, and they really want to sit more or less on the same rung, which is something that they really don't want to do in the case of the standard Fermi-Hubbard ladder. And this is to some extent actually when I ran numerics in this, I was a bit surprised because over many years, people had told me, like in particular Eugene, that in ladder you always get pairing automatically, but it turns out that in a Fermi-Hubbard ladder, you do get pairing, so pairs of charge carriers do form in the ground state, but the binding energies are pretty small. So in a finite temperature experiment like this, I mean, this is what you get, right? You never actually see pairs. You need to go to much lower temperatures to really see pairs of charge carriers in a normal Fermi-Hubbard ladder. But for this mixed dimensional case, what you did is basically not worry about going to lower temperatures, but instead bumping up the binding energies. So this is pretty cool, and I mean, there's a lot to explore here on this front because I mean, the natural thing would be to also do bilayer systems, which can be experimentally done, and of course also look at what's happening at finite doping. And now the other thing we can do in mixed dimensions is to go away from this like ladder or bilayer limit and go to an actual like 2D spin system. So basically look at what happens if you have like a 2D spin system. So far we look kind of at the bilayer limit, where this J-perp was also a strong coupling. Now we're looking at the case where this J-perp is the same as the J-parallel. Sadly, we're not really looking at very large two-dimensional systems, mainly because we are doing matrix product state calculations, and it's kind of difficult going into the large 2D limit. But again, we are looking at the same, more or less the same model as before, and just a different parameter limit where this J-perp and the J-parallel are the same now. And in this case, of course, there's like a whole phase diagram to explore, but it turns out that if you look at the temperature over doping, you get a very large regime with stripes. So the stripes basically look something like this. So this is, I think somewhere, I don't know, here, where the hosts want to sit more or less on top of each other. And then the spin correlations kind of stay the same as you go over the hosts. So you basically don't get this kind of domain wall here in the spin sector, but you really just can ignore the holes and keep getting your anti-ferromagnetic ordering within the spin sector. So there is a large regime in which you see stripes. And then there is this kind of charge and gas phase where you don't get stripes, where you only have short range AFM correlations. The holes kind of move through this anti-ferromagnetic background and mess it up. And we don't really like, so what we want to look at basically is in this charge and gas regime, what's really going on there? Right. And the point is, and that's kind of something that already in the 2D system that I showed you before happens, is that the motion of the holes induces frustration. Because the holes kind of move through a spin background, they disarrange the spins, and therefore they basically induce these frustrating couplings. And you see this in a way in this mixed dimensional system, because we can go to squeeze space. So, and that's kind of the nice thing about like the mixed dimensional systems, where they lend themselves perfectly to that. Because so squeeze space means in a way what I was showing here in like a strictly 1D system, you can kind of squeeze out your hole out of the system. Which means that if you like you have spin charge separation in 1D, that's nice, but you have a direction in which you can squeeze out the holes because the holes anyways can only move in 1D, right? So since the holes can only hop in this one direction, you can basically go to the squeeze space, which just means you remove all the holes through the system to the right of the system. In a fully 2D system, this is hard because you don't know whether you should squeeze in this direction or in this direction, right? In the mixed dimensional system, you kind of get the best of both worlds because you get the 2D spin background, but you get this 1D feature that you can go to squeeze space. And why am I so eager to go to squeeze spaces? Because I basically want to see what happens with the spin background if we remove all the holes, right? And I need a prescription to remove the holes. going to squeeze space is one. So going to squeeze space basically means to move the holes just all the way to the right of the system. And if I do that, you directly see what happens is that these two spins, there's like this coupling induced, because before I had moved the holes, like here, these guys were nearest neighbors. So there is basically an S dot S term happening between them. And this is kind of a frustrating coupling in the original model. Okay, so if I go to squeeze space, what this really means is I just move all of my charges to the right of the system, and I end up with a snapshot which only contains spins. Crucially, I kind of need these snapshots to do that, right? Because without snapshots, there is no way I can actually go to squeeze space. So this is kind of very challenging to do just based on these average, like average quantities, because I really need to have this squeeze space picture. Like for that, I really need to have single snapshots through which I can move my holes now. Okay, so what I end up with for a given original snapshot of my DJ model, I end up with a snapshot just of the spin background in squeeze space. And the question is now, how can you best describe this kind of spin background alone? Okay, yes. So this is kind of the types of pictures that I end up with. And what is kind of drawn for this single snapshot here are these like diagonal couplings. And I'm saying that these are frustrating because if you look at it, what you end up with is kind of on a single plaquette, you end up with like antiferromagnetic couplings all around. So this is kind of a J1, J2 type of situation where you don't know what to do, right? So for example, if you start with putting like down next to up, and then you also want to have down next to up along the vertical direction, but then you already screwed up the diagonal direction, right? So there is no way to make, like, you can also make the diagonal direction happy, but then the vertical direction is unhappy. So basically, this is really like an example of geometric frustration because there's no way to make this entire plaquette happy here. And the reason we get these diagonal bonds again is just induced by the hole motion. So we started out with the model where you only had these nearest neighbor spin exchange interactions, but then due to the hole motion, these diagonal interactions got induced. And this is kind of something that I'm just telling you now. You're like, you can or cannot believe me. But what we're going to do is we go to squeeze space and ask what Hamiltonian, what spin Hamiltonian best describes these snapshots now. And so this is basically what the spin correlations in squeeze space look like. So we have no holes left anymore. We go to the squeeze space, and like out of these squeeze space snapshots, we can now evaluate all of the spin correlation functions. And what you see is, okay, the border is a bit special because the hole tends to sit in the middle of the system. So we only care about the middle of the system. And what happens in the middle of the system is, so the two correlations we are looking at here is the C1y, so that's kind of these straight correlation functions. They start out being negative, right? Because you start out from antiferromagnetic background. So kind of a nearest neighbor correlation function is negative, and it stays negative, but its absolute value gets smaller. And the other correlation function we're looking at is the C2, so this diagonal correlation function here. And this diagonal correlation function is originally negative, because if you, it's originally positive, because if you start out from a like an antiferromagnet, what you have on the diagonals, these two spins tend to be aligned. But now, through the hole motion, you actually end up with correlations that are negative, so anti-aligned. And turns out these values are actually pretty similar. So the straight bonds and the diagonal bonds end up being not that different at all in the center of your system. So this is really the effect basically between here, the border of the system, and the center of the system is really the effect on the spin correlations that the hole motion had. And what we're trying to do now is describe this spin system that we're seeing here with this type of J1, J2 Hamiltonian. So we're asking basically, if I take a J1, J2 Hamiltonian, will this be a good description, like a thermal state of this Hamiltonian, will this be a good description of the spin correlations that we're seeing in our model? And there is kind of two nice features out of this. One is that we have SU2 invariants. So we started from an SU2 invariant model. And of course, there's no way we break SU2 invariants with what we're doing. And this means that even though we are trying to learn in like a Hamiltonian, which has terms that are not only SCSC, but also SX, SX, and SY, SY, it's enough to look at snapshots in a Z basis. So we don't need to go to any other basis just because we anyways have this SE2 invariance. And the other nice thing is that to now learn the Hamiltonian of the system, we only need to numerically simulate a spin Hamiltonian. So in principle, if one were to build like a large quantum simulation setup of this mixed dimensional model, which would could be larger than what we can simulate on a computer, to do what we're doing now, to figure out how much frustration this whole motion really induces, we only need to numerically simulate a spin Hamiltonian. We don't need to simulate a charge sector at all. Okay, so the whole Hamiltonian reconstruction works now in this way. So we have a Hamiltonian, which is some sum of like local or like semi-local terms. And what we want to learn is those coefficients mu. So in our case, this is just the couplings J1x, J1y, and J2. But it could be also more terms. And we have a thermal state of this Hamiltonian. So this is our kind of squeeze space images is what gives us this thermal state. And it turns out that the only thing that we need to measure now is actually the expectation values of these terms that show up in the Hamiltonian. And so this is something that's kind of nicely shown in this paper here. What you need to do is really only measure those and then find a quantum state that basically gives you the correct expectation values and also maximizes the entropy, or vice versa, minimizes the free energy. Okay, and so what we really do, we have kind of an objective function that we're trying to minimize, which is given by exactly that, that we need to maximize the entropy. So we basically do gradient descent of this function. And it turns out, actually, if you calculate the actual gradient of this thing here, the only thing that comes out is the difference between your measured correlations and your simulated correlations. So for a given guessed Hamiltonian that you're trying to reconstruct, you basically, in, within this term here, you will have terms kind of these m simulated. And the only thing that really enters in the end is the m simulated and the m measured, the difference between those. And then you do gradient descent. And it actually also turns out that for like a Gibbs state, this is a convex problem. So it's something that's bound to work very nicely. And this is what you see here also. So in this case, you're looking at the gradient descent that we do. We start with a guess of all our parameters just set for one to one. So you could also start like in some other point in the parameter space. We just randomly started like all of them set to one. And then you see that within this gradient descent, where these kind of couplings go to. So this is for one particular case of our phase diagram model. And basically, what happens if you look at the kind of spin background, so this is the sort of phase diagram that you get. So this is the combined order parameter. You have here this J1y coupling, so the nearest neighbor coupling in this direction, and here the J2 coupling. So the J2 coupling is kind of what the whole motion induces in your system. And okay, if you start here in the top left corner, which is not even on here, you just get your antiferromagnet because you just have no J2, so no frustrating couplings, and just like equal J1x and J1y, so equal nearest neighbor correlation strength. Down here, you have very strong J2. In that case, you also get an ordered phase, which is the striped AFM phase. But in between, you get this frustrated regime. And so in this frustrated regime, basically your system doesn't know what to do because you have like strong diagonal couplings, but also strong straight couplings in all directions. So you end up in this frustrated regime, and people are debating what kind of quantum spin liquid or not you have in there. But it's clear that it's kind of a highly frustrated and very interesting regime of this J1, J2 model. Now, if you do our Hamiltonian reconstruction for this squeeze space, what we see is that we very quickly end up in here. So the different data points that you see is for different values of the doping. As we put more doping, like more holes into the system, they mess up the spin background more and more. And pretty quickly, already like on something like between 10 and 15% doping, we end up here in this highly frustrated regime. So what this really tells us on a quantitative level that putting holes into your antiferromagnet induces frustration in your system and brings you into something which is kind of even a spin liquid phase. It's of course a finite temperature state, so you're not in the ground state of the system or anything. But you end up in this frustrated regime, and this is kind of goes back all the way to what Anderson originally said, right? That you end up with something like a kind of RVB state. And turns out you just need to, you know, look only at the spin background to make that true, that you end up with this soup of singlets here. Okay, I've talked for a long while. With this, let me summarize. So we saw strong pairing, and we also saw how the motion of those holes can induce frustration. And I think this like mixed dimensional, like this is just to show you these mixed dimensional systems are something where there's a lot to explore and a lot to play around with all sorts of tools here. My collaborators.
Questions?
I have a question about the last part. So is there a reason why you expect the effect of Hamiltonian to be local? Because you're kind of moving all the holes to one side, which is kind of a non-local operation. So
yes, yeah.
The reason?
Yeah, that's a good question. So so first of all, yes, it's a non-local operation, which is nice because you really, that shows you, right, that you really need to do it with those snapshots. And yes, it is a non-local operation, but if you move the holes, what you also see is that you don't really induce any, like within this picture, you don't really induce any long-range interactions, but you only induce interactions, like in this case, these diagonals, right? And to really get more long-range interactions into your system, what you would need to have is like many holes moving, like basically if you had, for example, all your holes sitting in one leg and moving past there, then you would get longer because this would go like longer and longer in this direction. But if you only have like more or less like equal number of holes moving through each leg, it's very unlikely that you get more than these next nearest neighbor interactions in here. So yes, the operation of going to squeeze space is something non-local, but this non-locality is kind of within the spin charge correlations. But since we then end up not looking at the charge sector anymore, the what happens in the spin sector is more or less local. And yeah, we also checked basically what happens if you include longer range correlations in here, and it turns out they very quickly decay with this.
Okay, thanks.
Questions?
Yeah, sort of shown evidence for pairing of charge-ons, but do they condense into a superconducting state?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good question. I don't know yet, and this is definitely something to explore, yes. In principle, so what's good is that they are mobile, right? So it's not like you have like static pairs of charge carriers sitting around. So that's certainly in their favor, but really what happens at finite doping, I don't know, and I think it's very interesting to explore.
So your strike phase, is it a period four stripe, or you know, that's what you sort of depicted, but is the,
this one here?
Yeah, versus doping, for instance, is that?
Yeah, I mean, this depends on doping, and it depends on whether you have a commensurable amount of holes in there, and like,
yeah.
But this is like purely more or less determined by the density in the system. Because we always put the same amount of holes in each leg, right? So it's kind of easy to see which doping you need to go for to fit which wavelength into the system.
Yeah, okay.
If you're Hamiltonian learning there, you have to, I didn't quite get it. Did you have to calculate the gradient of the partition function, or the log of Z there?
Yeah.
Or did you say that, or you don't have to calculate that term?
Yeah. So,
yeah, that's
basically, right. Yes, if you, like, I mean, what you do is you calculate the gradient of this. You do like do the derivative after your couplings in your Hamiltonian, right? And if you do that, it turns out that you, I mean, okay, I needed to write it down for myself, but what you end up with is really just exactly the same terms as here, just that it's not what you measured, but like in here, like it's just the terms in the Hamiltonian, like, and your Hamiltonian looks something like, I don't know, some. Yeah, okay, basically you have some mu L times EL, right? And now you basically have your I think I'm standing exactly in your way to see it, but and then mu L EL, and then you basically have your partition sum here. And it turns out if you now do the derivative after these mu L's of the thing, you just get these ELs out, and like these ELs, I mean, kind of bad nomenclature, but these ELs are of course exactly these M's. So it looks more complicated than it is in the end, because I mean, this is of course formally what you do, right? Because you kind of minimize the free, you maximize your entropy, you minimize your free energy. So technically, this is what you do. But if you then actually go and calculate the gradient, it turns out to be pretty neat and simple. I think it's like kind of like a feature of the Gibbs state. Like if you had any arbitrary state, of course, this doesn't.
Okay, last chance for online questions. Going once, gone, okay. All right, let's thank everyone again.